Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in today. This is a weird one, and it's going to go a lot of places, Noel, but it's going to start with, fun fact, one of the very few animals on this planet that I actually don't care for. And you know, I'm a real softy when it comes to animals in general.
I know, you're a real animal lover, Ben, and my name's Noel, and I'm an animal liker. I don't know if a lover, and I know that in your book that would probably make me something of a sociopath, but I promise I'm a nice person. I do like animals. I just, you know, there's some I could take or leave.
Well, you know, we can agree on the subject of today's episode for sure. I mean, the best of us, super producer Casey Pegram, probably doesn't even like these animals. He's on adventure, so he might not have a comment today, but I think it's safe for us to say that all three of us are fairly anti-flea.
The three of us, me, you, and super producer Casey Pegram.
That's right.
But to bury the lead here, we have a fourth today. Well, actually, it's a third because Casey's on adventure, so we've been teasing this for an age, but we're finally making good on our promise to bring back to Ridiculous History. I present to you Gabe Lussier.
Oh, hey, thanks, guys. Very, very nice welcome back. I feel good to be here. I know last time we chatted about cats for a good long while, mm-hmm. So it's only fitting, mm-hmm. I think, that we talk about another kind of animal often associated with cats today.
Oh, that's right. It didn't even occur to me. I mean, it couldn't be a more like polar opposite in terms of, I don't know, maybe there's similarities. Cats can be a little aloof, and perhaps there's some aloof fleas out there.
Oh, I don't know, man. Fleas are pretty extroverted. They're all about it. I hate them, but I'm fascinated by their abilities. If they were person-sized and, you know, the environment was such that animals with their kind of carapace could survive at that size, they would be a world-ending threat.
And how do they hop like that? How do they hop?
It's those legs, man. It's those powerful back legs, but I think we'll get to that.
Tiny. They look little. They look so, I mean, again, look, not that I've ever actually examined a flea up close. They really just look like little specks when you look at them with the naked eye, but contained within those little black specks are multitudes.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. So, Gabe, one approach I thought would be illuminating today would be for maybe you to tell us a little bit about what inspired you to go down this, let's not call it a rabbit hole, let's call it this flea hole. What mm-hmm. what brought you into this strange circus of obscure research?
Yeah, that's actually an easy answer. It is Jurassic Park. that's the first movie I actually have any memory of watching as a kid. And I return to it pretty frequently because it's a great movie. And one of the scenes that always stuck with me, it was my, you know, that movie was my first introduction to a lot of things, dinosaurs, theme parks, shirtless Jeff Goldblum, and also flea circuses. If you recall, there's that scene towards the end of the movie where John Hammond, the creator of Jurassic Park, waxes philosophical about one of his older careers, how he started out in the entertainment business. And it was with a flea circus. And that was the first time I had ever heard of such a thing. They really colored the way I looked at it from then on. I assumed, if you'll remember, his circus was a mechanical one, right? Like all of the attractions mm-hmm. Were run by gears and switches and that kind of thing. And there were actually no fleas featured.
Right.
That colored my way of looking at flea circuses pretty much up until about a week ago, I guess. I assumed they were all fake. And
I got to do it though, or as John Hammond would have said, it was flea circus.
Flea circus.
The fleas.
We fleas on trapeze. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. We fleas on trapeze. Oh, Gabe, so good. It. You really nailed it. That cadence. I love his lilting delivery. But fun fact, I didn't know this until recently, and I'm sure many people are going to just say, like, duh, Noel. The actor that played John Hammond is David Attenborough's brother.
Yeah, that's right. I included a link in our research doc about with Attenborough talking about flea circuses. He's got one in front of him.
So I always thought when I thought of flea circuses, I perhaps unfairly, well, definitely unfairly, relegated them to the world of novelty tents in the circus. You know, the stuff on the periphery. Like, okay. Sorry, Johnny, we got here too late to see the lion tamer and the elephants, but I can technically tell your mother that I did take you to see some animals. Come with me to the little tent.
Yeah, it's like a C-tier attraction, right? Yeah, that's kind of how I looked at it too, especially since, you know, in my mind, it was all fake. But what I found out in researching for this episode is that it wasn't always like that. Back in the original days of flea circuses, there were actual real live fleas performing. There was no mechanical allusion to it.
So fleas can be trained? Is that what you're saying?
that's fair. That's
debatable.
The claim.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. So some hucksterism involved on in both genre of flea
circus.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, one thing that was interesting to me that I was fascinated to find out was that leading up to their career in the circus, fleas actually had another job in entertainment. They were kind of like a Vanna White or kind of like those models that, you know, lounge on exotic sports cars at conventions. Cars weren't invented at this time, but they were like an add-on piece of advertising for watchmakers, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a very disturbing image you've painted of giant fleas lounging on cars. But it's accurate, more or less, because the origins of flea-based entertainment, I guess we can call it, goes all the way back to the 1500s with watchmakers, as you mentioned, and jewelers, too. I guess I don't want to leave them out. But the first guy to do this on record was this London watchmaker named Mark Scaliot, I think. What do you guys think?
Scaliot.
Yeah. We're going with that.
It wouldn't be an episode of Ridiculous History if we didn't like waffle struggling for a pronunciation. So thank you for keeping the spirit of the show alive.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And he's from London, so Scaliot is probably pretty close. We'd be in deeper water if he was, you know, Eastern European, then it's anybody's game.
Who even knows where that is? But yeah, so this guy, Mark Scaliot, which is definitely how you say his name, he's credited with having made, let me find a good description here. So he made a lock, which consisted of 11 pieces of iron, steel, and brass, all of which together, you know, made this little lock, which had a key to it. And if you added all that stuff up, it was so small, it only weighed the equivalent of 1 grain of gold. So this was super, super tiny stuff. But he didn't just make this lock and key system. He also made other very tiny objects. And the idea was to kind of flout his craftsmanship, right? He could work with these, you know, very intricate, tiny details, like the inner workings of a watch or, you know, the clasp of a necklace or whatever. So to kind of show off his skills as a watchmaker, he would make these very tiny little objects that still functioned, like the lock and key system. But he didn't stop there. He also made a chain of gold that consisted of 43 links. And once he had that made, he would actually attach it to the neck of a flea.
What? Flea flossing? Did he have something going on with that flea? Was that like his side flea?
Unclear, but he did not want to let it out of his sight. He actually yoked this little guy with this like kind of golden leash that he made. And this was a way, again, of kind of advertising his services. I assume he was doing this, you know, maybe in his shop window or, you know, just outside of his shop in the street. And the idea was, you know, see what fine work I can do on this tiny level. You know, if I can do this with a flea, if I can leash a flea, then surely I can handle, you know, gears and springs and stuff inside a watch.
We've all been there. You know what I mean? We've all had that thought process, right?
Yeah.
No? Only watchmaker in the crowd?
Well, I'm fascinated by it. It just seems like a lot of work and a lot of tiny parts that I would likely lose very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you lose one little gear and your whole watch is shot. So I leave that to the professionals.
Yeah, I think that's a good call.
Yeah, I should point out the watches I make are huge because otherwise I would instantly lose all kinds of stuff.
That's what we use for the timer in the Quister segment.
Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. true, but be careful with that one, Noel. We've been getting away with it for so long.
I think what you guys are describing is a clock, right? A large okay. watch.
Okay.
Not to
right.
be that guy, but.
All right. Dr. Professor over here. Yeah. Calm down. Yeah. Pump your brakes on those degrees. All no, right. I'm kidding. But you're describing something that I think is going to give a lot of folks in the crowd today, an immediate question. And I think it's a question that'll come up multiple times in this episode. Fleas are just so, so very small. I feel like the mm-hmm. casual passerby would just be able to see the chain, right? Unless they were very close or there was a magnifying glass or maybe there's, oh, you know what? Maybe it is. It's the 1500s. Not a lot of people could afford watches in the first place. So he's probably presenting these, maybe, right, to his limited customer base.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure about all of the details, but I do know that he wasn't relying on people's eyesight, right? He wasn't taking the flea for a walk on this little golden leash by himself. Instead, he made another very tiny, you know, handmade object, a chariot. And once you got the chariot and you have your harness and you have a little tiny flea to pull it, I mean, you got yourself a street show, right? Like, that's gonna catch some eyes. How is this chariot moving, right? Right?
I think the word you're looking for is parade. Parade is what they call that. Sorry, I'm just being pedantic back at you. Sorry, yeah, sorry.
I appreciate that. But no, I mean, this really was, though. This was how these guys would advertise. It started in the late 1500s, but they were doing this all through the 1700s. Like, this took off. It's not an isolated thing. We can question why, you know, it was a different era, but for whatever reason, people were really drawn in by this. So the really interesting thing about this time to me is that the fleas weren't really the star of these watchmakers and jewelry and these jewelers' shows. It was really the miniature objects that they were making. Those were the stars. The little chariot, the little lock and key, the little tiny harness. And that seems, you know, kind of strange, but at the time, again, we're in like the 1700s now, people in Northern Europe, you know, in countries like Germany and Holland and England, they were like way into miniature houses or cabinet houses, as they called them. I mean, we would just call them doll houses, but these were adult doll houses. They weren't really for kids, and they often didn't even have dolls in them. It was it was kind of like the feminine counterpart to the cabinet of curiosities, if that makes any sense. So, the husband would gather all of these kind of, you know, eccentric, eclectic, exotic objects from his travels and store them in this cabinet and show them off to visitors who would come over. But women of the era didn't get out of the house so much. So what they would do instead was they would build a miniature house in a cabinet, and they would have these, you know, super detailed, tiny pieces of furniture and utensils and other household objects. And they would just go to town decorating this thing. And when they had visitors over, they would walk them through each of the little miniature rooms.
Please witness my miniatures.
Indeed. It's funny. There was a bit of a moment not terribly long ago, or maybe a few years ago, where there were really popular YouTube videos of this thing that was big in Japan of like cooking tiny food.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. For hamsters, like, and stuff, right?
I guess it was never, not, I don't, I mean, it could certainly could have been, but the ones I saw were just for the pure pleasure of it.
Oh, wow.
But they would be like on a tiny stove where you'd put a little, one of those like, what do you call those candles? Tea light candles, mm-hmm. like inside this tiny stove, and then put a tiny thing and they'd scramble a tiny egg or just a little bit of egg and make a tiny omelet and plate it and then have tiny chopsticks on. That was a whole phenomenon. It seems to have gone away, but clearly, you know, similar vibes there.
Oh, yeah.
It's still there. What's interesting about that is that in this case, it seems that those hamsters or rodents were themselves ancillary to the larger conceit of building the or cooking very tiny food, just like the fleas were kind of just a new, like a little action figure to put in your Voltron of whatever cool toy you were showing off. And then, you know, that way, maybe when you had people over, they would be more likely to visit because they would be like, I cannot go to Wilhelm's again. All he does is show us those miniatures. And then someone says, no, he's got, it's active now. Yeah. He's got fleets.
And how dare you call it a toy? This is an artifact. This is an artifact.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. There is a strange long history of kind of miniatures being paired with showmanship and being made into some kind of an attraction, whether it was just walking your visitors, you're forcing your visitors to appreciate your tiny little house or making a little chariot and harnessing mm-hmm. a flea. It was all about the small object at first. Mm-hmm. But that started to change because of one man from Italy, a acclaimed showman known as, here we go. This one's going to be a little harder. Let's say Louis Bertolotti? Bertolotti?
Bertolotto.
Bertolotto. There we go.
Bertolotto. Yeah. Between the three of us, our powers combined, we have a halfway decent pronunciation.
Bertolotto.
I hear the key is to move your hands when you say it.
That helps.
Sort of throw your hands up when you hit that that L. Bertolotto.
Bertolotto. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got it. I think I got it.
Oh, boy. I keep digging this hole. But yeah, this guy is already a showman, right? He's not having one of those moments where he's working as a clerk or something and takes a hard pivot in his life. He's in the 1800s, though, right? Sometime after the watchmaker craze.
Yeah, my understanding is, you know, the watchmaker thing started in 1578 with that guy we mentioned. That went pretty much all through the 1700s with still this only kind of being used to advertise watches and jewelry and that kind of thing. And it was in the 1800s, so a little while later, where the focus kind of shifted and the fleas became the star of the show instead of the miniature set pieces. And we have this paradigm shift thanks to this Italian impresario we mentioned, Louis Bertolotto, who made his living in London and decided to put the fleas to work, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So he saw an opportunity, and we know that he would have been aware of this context, right? He was not the first person to think of this. But at the time, what I get the sense of from some of the research you dove into, is that it's not like maybe he was particularly financially desperate, but he hadn't really made it to the upper echelons of being an impresario. So this is something that's maybe new to his area. It has that tinge of otherness. And then it's also original, because at this point, where he's at in Italy, nobody is going to blow it up as much as he is. He's like the guy who said, let's make the flea the star of the show. And economically, it makes sense because, look, we're very careful not to dunk on the past here on Ridiculous History, but some observations are true. And one of those observations is there were a lot of fleas in Europe at the time. It was not expensive to get them the way it would be to like get a tiger or a bear. No,
that's absolutely true. It made economic sense. I mean, I think this guy was, a bit of a self-proclaimed impresario. Like, I don't think anyone at the top of their game is like, I know what I'm going to do now. The next natural step is a flea circus. But
he had entrepreneur in his Facebook.
Yeah. Top of his game. But he saw these watchmakers and jewelers doing this kind of thing. And he was like, well, okay, I don't know how to make a tiny chariot or anything like that. And I'm not interested in selling watches, but like, you guys have been burying the lead here, right? Like, these fleas are pulling chariots. And like, what else can we get them to do? So he rounded up a bunch of them and he started, you know, I'm not sure if he built the sets himself or if he commissioned them, but one way or the other, he put together a little circus. And he had the old favorites, right? Like, his fleas pulled tiny carriages and chariots just like the other guys. But he also had dancing fleas. And the music they danced to was provided by an orchestra, which was also composed of fleas playing tiny little instruments. And so that was something like beyond what the jewelers and watchmakers had done before. But Bertolotto took things even further than that, because he actually had his fleas like reenact the Battle of Waterloo. That was his big act. And wow. And remember, this was in the 1830s. So it had only been like 15 years since that battle. Like, it wasn't that long ago.
Which is that, that's my question. Is that in poor taste? Mm-hmm. Like, if 15 years after an intense conflict in Vietnam, I don't think people would want to see that reenacted by animals. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting human judgment on too much of a high horse.
Well, I think, you know, history has shown us that people very much wanted to see this.
Yes.
This guy rounded up 435 fleas for this performance. He dressed them all in little outfits. He put them in golden saddles on these chariots carrying tiny little swords. And he held these mock battles. And that was kind of, you know, the main attraction of his circus. And people ate it up. Like, he was incredibly successful. He actually took this thing on tour for over 50 years. So for half a century, he was making a living off of this flea circus.
Oh, wow. And it wasn't always the same cast, I imagine, unless I am incredibly wrong about the lifespan of fleas.
No, yeah, you got that part right. That's one of the downsides to the business is there's a lot of turnover. Yeah.
I got to ask, like, what would I see visually? I don't understand. Like, how would he even do this? Like, a flea, maybe I'm not a flea expert, but it seems so small. Like, what does an outfit look like for a flea? How do you even get a sword in a flea's hand, claw? I don't understand. The logistics of this escape me.
Yeah, it ain't easy. But I mean, that's the question, right? I think you were kind of hinting at it earlier. Why was anyone doing this? Why put fleas in a circus? Like, why fleas, right? And I think, Ben, you already mentioned these things were really prevalent, especially at the time, like way more so in the 1800s than we would find today. And they were also quick to reproduce and, you know, they drank human blood. So they were easy to feed, right?
Didn't they Gross. Also spread plague?
Well, okay.
Or diseases in general, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is one important clarification. These weren't dog fleas, they weren't cat fleas, they weren't rat fleas. There were over 2,000, apparently, different species of fleas in the world. And these were human fleas, which we don't see or interact with too much now. But of course, they're still out there. It's still a thing. They're also, you'll find them on pigs a lot, not just humans. These human fleas were everywhere. People had them in their beds. It was a worldwide pest. So one thing about these human fleas is they were a little bigger than your average flea.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, a dog flea might be like 2.5 millimeters. These guys were 4. So,
ooh, big boys.
Kaiju,
would this, would this, would this be sort of akin to what we think of as bed bugs today, or is that something different?
That's where people would encounter them the most, under their bed covers, and you would get really itchy. Like, there's a Laurel and Hardy and 2 Charlie Chaplin films where these human fleas are like a big part of the plot. it was a thing.
I'm sure hijinks commenced.
Yeah.
And so this is interesting because since he has embarked upon this quite successful multi-decade career, Bertolotto is getting around, and he kind of spreads this novelty act to places that have probably, I don't know, maybe never heard of it before or never seen it or been familiar. Like, if you're the average person in, say, North America, when he's at the height of his career, would you have heard of the concept of flea circuses, or would you have heard of the concept of Bertolotto's flea circus?
I think you would have heard of it and not seen it and had been very curious to see it. So maybe you read a report on it. Maybe there was a friend who, you know, visited Europe and came back and told you there's this crazy thing over there. They got fleas moving chariots. They're putting these guys to work. Why aren't we doing that here? And at least one guy agreed. In the early 1900s, an American named William Heckler was one of the first guys to kind of take this idea and run with it in North America.
Also the inventor of the heckle, right?
Yeah, of course. Right. He heckled his own circus, but yeah, and it took off here too. Like his circus could bring in more than $250 in admittance fees, you know, for a single showing, which is, you know, well over $3,000 in today's money. So not bad, right?
Not bad at all.
And you know, other copycats came along too in North America and in Europe. Everybody kind of got in on this. They started taking these flea circuses on the road, going from town to town, like, you know, medicine road shows. And over time, flea circuses just became linked with those, you know, carnival sideshows that we're all used to seeing at the circus or county fairs. People, it just became an expected form of entertainment.
Okay. So, you know, why fleas? You've definitely answered one, these particular fleas. Because they were a little bigger and prevalent. They were available. They were easily reproducible. In fact, they did it themselves. They were just everywhere. We talked a little bit earlier about their fantastic jumping abilities, which that's, to me, the coolest, least disgusting feature of the flea. And I think this played into it a little bit as well as to why fleas, yeah?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, fleas are, you know, the best jumpers that the natural world has to offer. Don't tell kangaroos. And human fleas in particular have really strong back legs, like stronger than the fleas you'd find on a cat or a dog. So they're kind of well suited for the kinds of tricks that these guys were having them do in their circuses. And again, the other thing that we mentioned is they were really easy to care for, right? You just roll up your sleeve and, you know, let them have a taste. And, you know, under conditions like that, these fleas could live for up to a year. Most of them wouldn't make it past like 3 months or so. So you still run into that problem of kind of having to start over with a new cast every so often. But if you really doted on them, if you nursed them, you could, you know, they could run out the calendar year.
You are of my blood. Go forth on your tiny chariot. Show Waterloo to the people.
Seriously, they would like interview the vampire style, like roll up the old sleeve and give them a taste. That's very strange.
They could have taken this in so many directions. You know, you've got one that lives, like you were saying, up to a year. Just let that old flea be in its own display and call it the Methuselah flea.
Indeed.
Add some zeros to the end of that 1 year.
No one will know.
Totally. No one will know. Send him to the flea stud farm.
Exactly.
So at this point, you know, the thing about fleas is, and I've been pretty openly anti-flea in this episode, so I hope I don't poison the well here too much. But the thing about this is that the closer you drill into their physical capabilities, Noel, like you said, the jumping ability alone, you see these amazing, somewhat terrifying powers. But there's a question that we haven't answered yet. And that's a question we kind of flea jumped around a little in the beginning, which is, were they actually being trained? Do fleas actually have the capacity to learn and retain and then apply information? This gets into the art of how flea circuses work, and maybe why not all flea circuses are created equally. But gentlemen, I propose that is a part two of this episode. What do you guys think?
I second that. Yeah. There's a lot more to say.
And you know how much we love a planned two-parter. So good on us. And yeah, plenty of juicy flea facts and trivia to come.
That's right. We did it. Gabe, thank you so much for coming on part one of the show. Due to the contract you signed in blood before we started rolling. You are obligated to be here for part two, but I think you would have come along for part two anyway. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the blood oath was a little extra, but you know, we gotta cover our bases.
Yeah, we'll never know legal. For sure.
<It's true. laughs> Legal is really into those lately, which we should probably look into at some point. But in the meantime, we hope that you found this as bizarre a story as we have. Join us for part two when we explore how the flea circus sausage gets actually made.
Sausage?
Ugh. Very gross.
Flea sausage. Well, the United Nations has a pretty strong argument for the importance of the possibilities of consuming insects as protein. Hopefully, I don't think fleas are on the list. How many fleas would it take just to make like one sausage pat? Wow.
Tune in next time to find out.
That sounds like the setup for a corny joke, which is very on brand for Ridiculous. How many fleas does it take to make an omelet? Like a flea omelet.
You want to make an omelet, you've got to break a few fleas. Okay, well, anyway, that's going to be our show. As always, thank you so much to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thanks, as always, to Alex Williams, who composed this amazing track. And Gabe, thanks to you, man.
Hey, you're welcome.
Huge thanks. Huge thanks to Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, who will be joining us in corporeal podcast form in the near future. Just like Gabe, he's a real person too, we promise. We did a really fun episode with him years ago about cover songs, weird cover songs. That was a fun one. Wonder what he has in store for his next appearance. You'll have to wait and find out. Thanks to Eve's Jeff Coates. Check out her show, This Day in History Class, and J.Ill, the podcast featuring the marvelous and the talented Jill Scott. And thanks to you, Ben. Thanks for being my flea pal.
Oh, hey, thanks to you, Noel.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.